For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I'm very happy tonight to have giving our talk Douglas Floyd, who's our director and chair of our board here at Ancient Dragons Zengate, former Eno. So thank you, Douglas.
Thank you. Good evening. It's January in Chicago, so it's dark, wet, and cold. And when it isn't dark, wet, and cold, it's dark and colder. And our minds are conditioned, they respond to our environment. And so over the last few weeks of cold, wet, and dark, I've found my mind becoming sort of at least cold and dark. I don't know what a wet mind would be. So naturally, my thoughts turned to death. Knowing that at the beginning of Dharma talk, I really became interested in the case that's been distributed to you. It's called Master Ma is Unwell. It's also sometimes titled Sun Face Buddha, Moon Face Buddha. This is the version, case 3, from the Blue Cliff Record, which I know is Taigen's favorite. It's also case 36 in the Book of Serenity. And I'm not going to try to cover the pleaders and the verse and notes, but I think it's good to read the case and the verses that Shredo wrote, and you can read it in your spare time. So, Great Master Ma was unwell. The temple director asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" The great master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." And Shredo's verse is, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. What kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years, I have suffered bitterly. How many times have I gone down into the blue dragon's cave for you? This distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed, patch-robed monks should not take it lightly." I really love that, those verses. So, this is the story of Mazu, who's one of the greatest Zen masters of the classic period. He was a very large, imposing, intimidating man. His most famous characteristic physically was that his tongue was long enough that it could touch the tip of his nose. And he was famous for shouting and hitting with a stick. But when this happens, those days are behind him. You know, the case is titled Master Ma is Unwell, and Shredo says Great Master Ma was unwell. The record of Mazu makes it clear that he died the next day. So it's not really that Mazu was unwell, Mazu was dying. So the temple director asks him, "How has your venerable health been in recent days?" This is, everyone knows what's going on. He's not just asking, "How you doing?" He's very concerned. And Mazu says, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." And you have to explain that in the the Buddha Name Sutra, which I cannot imagine has been translated, it explains that sun-faced Buddhas live for 1,800 years and moon-faced Buddhas live for a day and a night, so 24 hours. So it's pretty clear that Mazu is comparing himself to a moon-faced Buddha. He's dying. But what does he mean by sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha? I mean, this is a teaching opportunity for the student who sees his master dying. And I have to add, is this saying, it's all Buddha. I've been healthy with a long life in front of me, and it was Buddha, sun-faced Buddha, and now I'm dying, it's moon-faced Buddha. It's all Buddha. It's good with me. Is he saying, look, you become enlightened, you have some realization, and your problems are gone. You don't really care if you're going to die. You don't care if you're sick or in pain. You don't care if you're hungry, or if someone you love has died, or today you've lost a job, anything like that. I don't think that's quite it. I think no one here does, just based on the practice that you've done. And I think everyone is aware that Zen and Buddhism are not a form of escape where you can paper over suffering with some sort of image or idea that it's all one, it's all Buddha, it's all okay, and that there is no single experience or realization that will make you calm or happy and clear-minded forever. That's not how it works. So I guess that my understanding would be that Mazu is speaking from his own life, and he's saying, when you're healthy and you have a long life ahead of you, be sun-faced Buddha. When you're sick and dying, be moon-faced Buddha. Those are just stand-ins for all of the conditions that can occur in our life. So it's been for me kind of a tough 12 months. I had about a year ago, I had two close friends die. I had a son move away from Chicago. I tore a knee to pieces. So I've been, tried to be at any rate, grieving Buddha, lonely Buddha, gimpy Buddha. whatever. What does that mean? The answer is that we have to come to ourselves and drop off body and mind. We have to drop off the clinging that we're engaged in almost all the time and open to the world, which includes ourselves and all of the conditions of our mind, so that we can recognize ourselves as intimate with this world and with these conditions and act as Buddha. So it could be anything. You know, most of the time we live with a constant predisposition of neediness or defensiveness. It's not just that, you know, there's a lot of writing about Zen in English that looks like, treats it, the mind is very passive, that we perceive the world and we sort of filter it through clinging and so on. Our mind is much more active than that. We just don't, it's not that we have experience and we decide, oh, well, that would be pretty good. I want that. Our mind is set up through biology, karmic dispositions, experience, teaching throughout our life, to constantly be looking at the world as something that threatens us or that's going to fulfill a need. We actually are reaching out for that, looking for something that's going to satisfy us or make us more secure. And if we grab the right thing, then we lock onto it and we perceive everything, including, it can even be intangibles, thoughts, imagine situations as objects of desire or objects that threaten us. And so we're constantly in a sense of separation from the world. You know, our practice here is, I mean, we know that we don't stop that. We can't stop thinking. You know, we've talked about Bajang and the Fox, you know, that a monk of great cultivation is not free from causes and conditions. A monk of great cultivation clearly sees causes and conditions, or is intimate with causes and conditions, and that's what we do. Throughout our life, both on the cushion and off the cushion, we wake up. We realize that we've waked up. We've come out of this constant whirling stream of thoughts and actions and speech that we're reflexively engaged in and not really aware of, as we're doing it most of the time. But we can step out of that and cultivate willingness to sit with that experience, whatever's going on, the sounds here, the smells of incense, pain in your legs, anxiety about what's going to happen at work. But being aware of those things is itself liberating, because you know that, you know, we did. You can many of you know about the chain of dependent origination, the whole description of 12 steps in a chain that describe how our life works, and it distills into the fact that our life is largely, and our suffering is a construction of clinging, craving, and lack of awareness of how that's working. And if you can take any element out of that, it falls apart, at least momentarily. So we sit on our cushions, or we live our lives, and we notice that we're awake. And our training, that's different from if we haven't had training, is that we recognize that, and instead of immediately going on to the next thing, we can say, okay, I'm willing to be here with that. I'm willing to feel the gimpy leg. I'm willing to be here and be lonely, or I'm willing to be here and grieve. If we don't do that, our experience goes around and around and around in the wheel. It's reinforcing itself all the time. In the sense of unsatisfactoriness, in the sense of separation from the world and being enclosed in on ourselves, becomes more and more intense. Awareness allows us to see through that. We disengage from that. It's there. But we become people who are grieving. We are not the embodiment of grief or just a gimpy leg walking around with somebody. We are someone who feels a gimpy leg. And being able to see through that, we have the space to act in a way which isn't impelled by need and insecurity. We can act as Buddhas. And as we disengage and the energy of that experience dissipates somewhat, we can be, the sense of separation can attenuate, and we can see through that and become intimate with our world. We are not, can not only act as Buddhas, we can recognize ourselves as part of Buddha. So, I think that's what Master Ma's lesson is. That no matter what your circumstances are, you have to be prepared to live consciously in those circumstances, to be intimate with them. Whether it's being a healthy sun-faced Buddha, a sick, dying moon-faced Buddha, gimpy Buddha, grieving Buddha, lonely Buddha. There's not freedom from suffering, but freedom within suffering. But other people have taken on this problem as well. And there's a koan in the Mumonkai. Case 47 is not just one case, it's three cases. And it's called Doshwai's Three Barriers. There are three questions, two of them are about death. And the second one has always intrigued me. When you have attained your self nature, you can free yourself from life and death. When the light of your eyes is falling to the ground, when you're in the moment of dying, how would you free yourself from life and death? That's the question. That's a question I think that it's worth asking ourselves. And the answer to that question is very much an answer about how we would live our lives now, in addition to at the moment of our death. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
So good. We have time for questions, comments, discussion. I want to just start, Douglas, thinking again about Ernie Banks, sun-faced Buddha, who's now dead Buddha, passed away Buddha. But he's not dead. Of course, he's alive and in the hearts of many people in Chicago. But so you spoke about facing grief and loss and sadness. How do we, sometimes it's hard to face joy, to smile in the middle of the zazen. Can you say something about that, please?
You know, joy can be a real challenge in zazen because it's a kind of a sticky kind of experience, right? You do, mm-hmm. You start feeling joy and you start going, well, this feels really good, and start sort of getting caught up in whatever that feeling is. And the way these things work is once you drift away from right now, all sorts of other things start going. But I would never say try to stop feeling good in zazen. So.
Thank you. So, please, comments, questions, responses, Sunil.
So this might sound a little ridiculous, but what I'm curious about is once you're aware of who you are, you face your death, your fear, or whatever you're facing, where do you go from there? Like, how do you move forward in a sense? Yes, I'm aware that I'm grieving, but oftentimes it seems like a lot of teachings just leave you there. Like, be aware, then what happens after that? What do you do after that? Do you have anything?
Whatever the next thing is that you need to do, then you act and engage with that. What is it that, you know, by becoming aware and intimate with that feeling, you have opened up and become intimate with the moment. What is the next step that you're thinking you need to take?
I don't know. I think that's the question in a sense, like, how do we guide, what do we do next? Like, how is that going to be different acting without being aware of it being aware? Like, how do I find that whatever I'm doing is I'm aware and I'm doing it without being aware and doing it? Like, how is that going to be different?
I think you can't really tell by watching someone, can you? Frequently? You can see someone being very angry or carried away by emotion, you have a pretty good idea, but otherwise, you can't tell. I think, you know, I think that having stepped outside of fear or greediness and anxiety, we naturally tend to open up and open up to other people and to whatever we're doing differently. But there are no special enlightened actions or ways of action. It's being awake as you do each thing and awake in each moment.
Other comments or responses, please feel free.
Does anybody have experience with grieving Buddha or gimpy Buddha?
Does anybody not have experience with grieving?
At the end of Sashin, has anybody felt like gimpy Buddha?
Jen.
I guess many people know that the precious mirror samadhi is my favorite, and so everything that Doug says reminds me of something in the precious mirror samadhi. But I think I'll just confine it to the line that says, "You are not it, but in truth it is you." And I love the Gimpy Buddha, the grieving Buddha, that, you know, Buddha is always there, but then these other things are not, you are not it, but it is you. And that was just one of my reactions to this.
I like the precious mirror samadhi because it keeps pushing me back to not letting you think that Buddha is something outside of the things of this world. The specific things. The imagery over and over again brings you back to things.
Well, also the line that says, "This practice human function secretly, like a fool, like an idiot." And you touched on that one too. There's factor of the imagery is really strong in the precious mirror.
Yeah. And there are all sorts of images of the spaciousness of being awake and not caught up in the usual preoccupations and still paying attention to specific things, you know, the images about how we penetrate the source, travel the pathways, embrace the territory and treasure the roads. So this openness, but we walk a specific road. There's the spacious openness of the experience of Buddha, but it's always with specific things. There's not something behind it. Mm-hmm. Buddha is not a thing that we see.
Claire?
What you were saying about grieving and the question of what next and what difference does it make to be awareness or to be aware brought back to me a memory of being in the emergency room in the middle of the night, right after I'd finished the sashin, and I was stuck in the waiting room for hours on end. And next to me, there was a father and son. Or, I'm sorry, a mother and son. And the mother was dying. Mm. And her son's fear was palpable. And he was clearly grieving, and he was so caught up in it, he yelled at her for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. Why did you do this? How could you not take care of this? Why are you here? What is this? And blamed her for dying, basically. And all I could think was how painfully sad that it was that he wasn't aware of his own grief in a way that could have allowed him to reach out in those last moments of hers and comfort her and be there for her and for himself. It's an experience that has stuck with me ever since. And I just thought I'd share.
Dave?
Conversely, with help from my cousin who is a practicing Zen priest in California, I was called to my mother's house when she was dying. And I called Stuart. He said, be with her. Tell her what a good job she's doing. Tell her how hard it is for her, you know that, and what a good job she's doing, and stay with her and turn to the light. And my mother's dying is perhaps one of the most magical moments of my life, to be able to be with her in those final minutes and to be with her in an intimate way. And I remember when she finally breathed her last, I called Stuart and he said, well, be with her and stay with her, because sometimes the soul hangs around, and tell her that it's not, it's okay, that you'll be okay, that I'll be okay, to let her know that. And I did that. And miraculously, the curtains in our room all of a sudden just flew. And there was just a change in the energy. And it was just to be in a moment when you're grieving like that and to be aware of the other person. It was just, I don't know what to say. You know, it's inexpressible. And I've also been at times when grieving was just unbearable. Lost the child. And it's whether or not I could let go of that and be with that spirit. Those are hard things. Mm-hmm. Grieving. And it could be both ways. Something I'm attached to and just stay into, or something that I could just be with the other person, or be with that feeling and let it go, come back to the present.
So that witnessing, thank you so much, David, for sharing that, and Claire. I appreciate, Douglas, you're talking about how do we be in the midst of moon face Buddha. I know a lot of people in this room are dealing with death of loved ones impending, or recently, or friends facing that. And we've also talked about how that denial of grieving affects our world in terms of the denial of grieving for the things that are dying in our world and the species that are going extinct, and how that obstructs our being able to respond. I want to go back just briefly, and I want to also have other people's further discussion, but going back to Sunil's question, adding to what Douglas said about just meeting the next thing, there's also, in our practice, we chant the Bodhisattva vows, we have precepts, there's the intention, which isn't something outside of meeting the next thing, but it's this kind of positive attitude of, okay, how can I, we realizing connectedness, realizing that we're connected to each other, well then how can I help? And it's not helping somebody else at my expense, it's that we're all in it together, and how to be helpful. So these teachings of the Bodhisattva practices and of the precepts and of the Bodhisattva vows are about how we be with the next thing. So, you know, and I think respond to your good question, Sunil. So,
Other comments, responses? Bill?
To me, the hard thing that I don't really understand or that I try to deal with, I don't deal with it very well, is on the one hand, taking death seriously in the sense that there's, we have no right to waste moments of our lives, even though I've wasted many moments. On the other hand, not to dwell in death and to instead spend more time being grateful for being alive and to not be so fixated on it. I know I spent most of my 40s because that was the time when my parents died, my some close friends died. It seemed like for a while, every other day somebody was dying in my life, including a student I was very close to was murdered, another student I was somewhat close to died of a drug overdose, you know, just that kind of thing all the time. And I think I got worn out on death over during those 10 years and also thought that I, you know, if I think about death all the time, I'll kind of forget to live. And then I had my own near-death experience a few years ago, and I think that gave me a very different perspective on this as well. So I'm not saying I've really made that into any wisdom that I live by, but I do think about those two sides of the question.
Laura?
That's so interesting, Bill, what you said about not getting fixated on death and focusing on life. I think it's different for different people and at different times of life. I feel grateful for realizing I'm going to die because it makes me appreciate my life. It's like, all right, life is short. So it's almost like the other side of that coin. I got a crazy email this last week saying it was my high school 50th reunion. Would I come September 5th? And there was a long list of people that I graduated with, and the ones that had two asterisks next to them were dead.
It would not be a dead.
I mean, I've never been to any high school reunion ever before. It's, you know, Ohio. I think I'm going to go, but I had read through the list, and a lot of the names I had no memory of, but a lot of them I did. And I thought, wow, two asterisks. That's sort of quite a, anyway, sort of processing that. I feel like we should talk about death more, so I'm really grateful that you brought it up. It's sort of a big deal that we don't pay too much attention to. We sort of breeze by it, and unless we're in that. I mean, we're either in it mourning something, or we're not paying attention most of that. I mean, I'll speak for myself, it seems like. But we need to think about it when it's not right in front of us, too. Anyway, thank you.
Comments?
Well, I think we certainly hide from difficult subjects frequently.
Why should it be difficult? I mean, it just is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to go with it, finding it difficult sometimes. I think the task is more to learn to deal with the feelings that you have about it than to try not to have certain feelings, to not to think of it as hard or a loss.
But isn't there also another side of death where we almost Disneyfy or fantasize death in a sense? Our video games have death, and then people enjoy playing those. or our movies or our TVs have death, it's almost like it's okay, it's normal. And ideas, I think, goes both ways. And that's when somebody's really scared of, which I'm celebrating in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think that death in art and media is frequently extremely abstract. So we glorify something that's not very realistic. It's almost that it represents something else.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Douglas, and for everyone for this wonderful discussion and the difficulty of facing this, but this is our practice, and we'll continue to work with Sun Faced Buddha, Moon Faced Buddha. We'll close for now with the four bodhisattvas.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.